For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way towards salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. Or in the words of Paul, at present we see indistinctly, as in a mirror, but then face to face. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. With me in the cave, two of the most intelligent cave dwellers you're ever going to deal with, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell and Mr. Mark Tuttle. Guys, I'm pretty sure that you both sat through what was supposed to be a debate last weekend, turned into more of just kind of a recitation of irrational statements, one after another after another. It used to be a debate was something that where two people got together and exchanged ideas. Now it's becoming more two people getting together and exchanging accusations. Can we, as a society, what do we need to do to get back to the rationalism that we need to bring it all together?
You know, I don't know about you, Tim, but I remember back when I was studying symbolic logic, and we took Abraham Lincoln's, the Lincoln-Douglas debates. We took some of those, and we wrote them out symbolically to be able to get all the arguments, to be able to see, you know, the course
the
of thought of
the syllogisms.
So trying to do that with that last debate.
Not possible.
Not possible.
Not possible.
At all.
In fact, it was a exam. There's a lot of, if you want to actually study philosophical fallacies, that would be a good one. Like, because of the ad hominem attacks and the
That's
the
true.
Insults,
that's true. I mean, there's a lot.
You could probably
of
be easier to map those out.
You could probably make a course on informal logic right there, looking at that, if this is what not to do.
Right. Yeah, there were not a lot of advancing of sound arguments, I would say. That was lacking.
And it's not just, I mean, it, obviously the two presidential candidates, they're out front, and so it's very easy to kind of pick on them and point to the presidential election of just sort of complete lack of rationality within our society. But it's not just the presidential debates. I mean, there's almost been sort of this slouching towards irrational arguments that has been going on for a long, long time. And, we've talked a little bit about some of the reasons behind that, you know, the incongruity, I think, of different philosophical outlooks. And, in some ways, Friedrich Nietzsche was almost prophetic when he talked about, you know, eventually philosophy is going to become like a battle that you do with hammers. You know, you philosophize with a hammer, and whoever's able to whack the heck out of their opponent the best, he's the one that philosophically is going
to
win
the
day.
The will to power, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, the rationality has gone out the window, and it really is just a matter of who can assert themselves the best.
Well, it's this sort of crisis of truth, right? If there is an objective truth and we lack a or don't have a commitment to pursuing the truth, then it simply comes down, if the truth is up for grabs, then there's no point of me trying to convince you and I'm not open to being convinced by you. Therefore, then it just comes down to our wills. Who has the most will? Who's the strongest? This is something that's been written about a lot recently, especially by Pope St. John II, Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI have written about this sort of condition that we're in, this tyranny of relativism,
right?
Crisis of truth. This is what we're at, and you see it everywhere. I'll even mention a philosopher we've mentioned before too. You mentioned Nietzsche. I would say Nietzsche is prophetic in that he says here's where we're going, and I would agree that we've arrived. And the diagnosis, though, I think also can come from Alistair MacIntyre,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah,
in his book After Virtue, is a diagnostic of what we're in, which is this state of what we, I think, philosophers would call emotivism.
Right. And, you know, MacIntyre, really, he goes back to the Enlightenment, and he says, you know, at least as far as moral ethics, sort of the philosophy of morals, our language is broken at this point because of all of the transformations that came out after the Enlightenment. And you know, he uses the analogy of if you could go to a culture and they were using scientific terms, you know, like, the defibrillator said today, blah, 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 blah. And just using them in completely off the wall, bizarre ways that they were never meant to be used. So Sally, you're going to go to the experiment tonight? You know, things like that, that's kind of where we are with ethics and morals, that the language we use doesn't at all fit because we're not applying it to sort of the communities and situations that language was meant to specify. And so he goes through how we got to where we are today with sort of broken ethical moral language.
Yeah, this sort of cataclysmic rupture, right? Part of the modern project, of course, in the Enlightenment, was an intentional cleaving away from the past, right, to sort of reimagine things, because the past contained the traditions and things like that. They thought a lot of error, a lot of mumbo jumbo and superstition. So to be enlightened, and just the name itself, Enlightenment, kind of tells you about the certain kind of snobbery that they were intellectual snobbery they were engaged in, and a chucking off of everything to come before to sort of reimagine things. And so with that, though, came a lot of problems, a lot of errors, and we are the great inheritors of that. That emotivism that I mentioned is the state of affairs where there's a denial of objective truth. Truth claims don't really exist. High level of skepticism, and basically any claims that I might make to truth are really at root just emotional appeals. They're just ways of me really saying how I feel. And since feelings really don't have my feelings don't have a claim on anyone else, then everyone kind of has their own set of feelings. Therefore, you know, there's no way to kind of resolve differences other than through power struggles.
Right. And, you know, the irony with that is that this move towards emotivism came out of a failed attempt
right.
to try to establish everything based on reason. So, you know, the Enlightenment, the whole idea behind it is
drats, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, the whole idea was, well, you know, this older scholastic philosophy, you know, the ancient philosophy, you know, it's very
clear. That can't be right.
It's based off of tradition. It's based off of a lot of things that aren't reason.
Stale, brittle.
Exactly.
We need to do something different.
So starting with Descartes, the move came, we're going to strip all of that away and we're going to try to start from pure reason.
Right.
And so this move towards pure reason ultimately failed, at least in McIntyre's view. You know, it ultimately failed. And so out of that failure, all that we were left with was emotions and trying to base things off of how I feel about a given situation to steer us, because there really is no grounding that can be there just on pure individualistic reason. Ethics revolves around communities, and you really need a community of shared values to build an ethics. And so what McIntyre comes to the conclusion is, you know, at this point, we've got two choices. We can either continue on this road of Nietzscheism, this road of philosophizing with a hammer, and whoever's the biggest, the strongest, and is
wins.
Able to be the biggest bully, on the stage at the debate, they're the ones that win. Or we can go back to Aristotle, and we can start looking at how to create these sort of communities of shared values from which we can build ethics.
Yes, that's that virtue ethic. And I think as a result, you know, what we see, we've been warned against, we see a lot of what? This emotivism is really sort of the passions, right, run amok. Our emotions, our passions being what? Our desires, right? Our desires for things. And going back to the ancient Greek philosophers, and then moving, you know, 2400 years ago, and then moving forward in time, we'd always been warned, and we see this certainly in the Catholic Church as well by the great saints, always been warned about letting our emotions or our passions get the better of us. Right? There's always been this in philosophy, this governing of the passions by the intellect, by our rationality, our reason should be situated over and above and direct our passions, because our passions can go what? Wild.
Right.
Right. They can be very strong, and they unguided, undisciplined, lead us in all sorts of really bad directions.
Yeah. You know, the ancient Stoics, I think, were probably the best purveyors of that, of trying to keep the passions and trying to keep our emotions under the control of reason, you know, allowing reason to control our reactions to things, allowing reason to govern our lives to a certain extent, so that we're not creatures of passion and creatures of the moment.
That we just follow our feelings, you know, wherever they may go.
Right. But you need reason. You need rationality to do it, which, you know, it's funny how, you know, you look at the history of philosophy and you look at the trends and things as they come and go. And then you look at, I think, the divine providence that brings about certain saints at certain times. And God seems to always have a particular saint for a particular time that he brings about. So
he sure does.
You know, when
who do you have in mind?
Well, you know, honestly, it's so funny because there's been this like almost closet resurgence in St. Thomas Aquinas. So you have Peter Kreft coming out, and you know he's writing a lot about St. Thomas Aquinas. You have other people writing a ton about St. Thomas Aquinas. There's this resurgence, and it brings back something G.K. Chesterton said. You know, he was writing about St. Francis. And, you know, the Victorians in England loved St. Francis. You'd walk around Victorian England and there'd be statues of St. Francis all
over
the place.
Yeah.
And you think about how opposite St. Francis was to the Victorians. I mean,
right.
And so, you know, G.K. Chesterton's observation is every age seems to find an opposite saint. And I think that's what we've done with our age. We found St. Thomas Aquinas really as sort of that counter saint to the irrationality that's just out there in the air.
Well, yes, I think, St. Thomas Aquinas for Catholics and other intellectuals, he's really the gold standard, right, when it comes to philosophy and theology, and his major work, the Summa Theologiae, is revered and studied for its depth, its beauty, its systematic a treatise, if you will, of the faith. And back with St. Thomas Aquinas, too, I mean, there was no separation between really faith and or theology and philosophy. It was all sort of ascending into into theology. And he was a Dominican, too, right?
Right.
And so the Dominicans were a relatively new order,
yep,
along with the Franciscans.
They were mendicant. They took vows of poverty. You know, all sorts of things that you look at today's day and age, and you just you sit there and go, why are people so fascinated with him today?
And it's their 800-year anniversary this year,
right? Exactly.
The founding of the Dominicans, and you know what? That's such a big topic, Mark. We better get some help.
I think so.
Why don't we bring a guest into the Catholic Cave and help us begin to sort of unpack some of this?
And I know the perfect guest.
Who's that?
Dr. Kevin Vost.
Yes! He's fantastic. He's a Catholic author, speaker, psychologist. So when we come back from the break, we're going to introduce Dr. Kevin Vost is going to join us. We're going to take a look at Aquinas. He's got a ton of great books out there. Psychology, philosophy. Stay tuned.
We'll be back with more right after this.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor, tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
I've got the spirit.
Hi, this is Teresa Tomeo from Catholic Connection.
Hi, this is Barbara McWiggin, host of The Good Fight here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Hi, everybody. This is Dr. Ray Guarendi, host of The Doctor Is In here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta, and you can join me for Cresta in the Afternoon here on Catholic Radio Indy.
The best of EWTN plus great local programming. That's what you get when you support Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome to the Catholic Cave. I'm still Timothy O'Donnell with Mark Tuttle, and we are super excited to bring into the Catholic Cave Dr. Kevin Vost. Kevin Vost is a really great author, Catholic author. He's a speaker, he's a professor. I hear you do a little radio too, Dr. Vost. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, I do. I do a little radio, though I must admit, I believe this is the first time I've ever been interviewed from a cave.
That's a first for most of our guests.
That's right. And the cave has a couple of meanings. One is, it's sort of a homage to Plato's allegory of the cave, but also, Mark and I are in radio for a reason. We're a bit we resemble Neanderthals.
Exactly. Yeah, we've got those caveman faces going.
That's
so
right. Well, Dr. Vost, we are thrilled to have you. And boy, I was looking over your books and the breadth of the topics that you cover. And boy, I'd love to just kind of dig in a little bit. Maybe a place for us to start for our listeners there. I would love for you to talk a little bit about I understand you're a convert, and one of your books is From Atheism to Catholicism, How Scientists and Philosophy Led Me to the Truth. I'd love to hear a little bit about the role of, say, you know, philosophy in your life and, you know, what the pursuit of wisdom has really done.
Sure. To really, you know, put a long 55-year story in brief in just a few seconds, I was raised a Catholic, went to Catholic school, we went to Mass, was taught by wonderful Dominican sisters. In my late teens, because of my passion for weightlifting and bodybuilding, I started following the writings of this brilliant young Mr. Universe, who also wrote about philosophy in addition to weightlifting and nutrition. And it led me to read some atheistic philosophers like Friedrich Nietzsche and Ayn Rand and Bertrand Russell. And I later became a psychologist, and there was this great psychologist, Albert Ellis, who was also an atheist. So I was reading these people. So in my late teens, that philosophy really pulled me from my faith. It led me to believe that the idea of God was either self-contradictory or God was unnecessary. So really, you know, there's a saying that, you know, a little bit of philosophy can lead to atheism. And that's what happened to me. So I considered myself an atheist for about 25 years until the age of 43, when through a series of events, I read the writings of St. Thomas Aquinas for the first time.
Oh, we love St. Thomas Aquinas, yes.
That's right. You know, and I would find out later when I came back to the church, one of our great popes, Leo XIII, writing in the late 1870s, he said, people who say they're only going to go by their reason, you know, they're just going to go by what's rational and reasonable to them. He said, what's going to draw them to the church is going to be the stirrings of the Holy Spirit, but then the writings of the church fathers and the scholastics, and primarily St. Thomas Aquinas, because he kind of sums them all up. But anyway, when I read Thomas, I kind of started with the second part of the Summa, where he talks about human nature. And through my training as a psychologist, I thought, wow, he knows us, you know, better than these great psychologists do. But then it pulled me, you know, into the first part where he writes about God, the proofs of God's existence, and just the attributes of God, what would God would be like, just based on what we can reason, and also to some extent based on what we glean from the scriptures. And then that's where I found Thomas had beautifully answered all those arguments of the atheists more than 700 years ago, and he's borrowing from church fathers and theologians and philosophers who wrote, you know, long before him. So to make a long story short, it was that writing of St. Thomas that gave me that great aha and was able to bring me back to Christ and the church.
Well, yeah, which is fascinating, because so many people today, I think, they look at St. Thomas Aquinas and they see him as sort of old-fashioned, maybe not particularly relevant. Yeah, I think a lot of people have the attitude, well, you know, today's philosophers, today's psychiatrists, we're all smarter than that. We know better than St. Thomas did back then. And yet you read his writings, and if you actually really read, and there's a little bit of a trick to reading St. Thomas appropriately, but if you dig in and actually read what he says, he's very fresh and very relevant to today's world.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, Thomas wasn't out there conducting psychological experiments, which kind of, you know, fine-tune our knowledge. But in the realm of philosophical psychology, what we can know about ourselves and others, you know, through our observations, through the observations of others throughout human history, I mean, he digs into these kind of perennial, you know, truths that last forever about, you know, what it really is to be a human being, what our passions are, how we think. And that is what wowed me. Yeah, there is so much in Thomas that is timeless, because he's just talking about the fundamental essence of things, you know, like human nature, you know, which doesn't change.
Hey, I appreciate that so much, and I know one of your other books is called the 1 Minute Aquinas, which sounds like an ambitious title, because anyone who's read Aquinas, I you know, he takes more than a minute typically. So this must be a labor of love on your part to try to make St. Thomas Aquinas accessible. What's going on in that book, 1 Minute Aquinas? What's your theme? What are you up to there?
Sure. I remember, you know, the person had a course kind of similar to mine, a person who wrote about philosophy but was actually trained in psychology, did not believe for a time, and ended up Catholic later in life, a man named Mortimer Adler.
Oh, I love Mortimer Adler. He's one of my heroes.
Yeah, mine too, you know, the great books, you know, and then he's like a Thomist. He was a Thomist even before he was a believer, in a sense.
Right. Aristotle for Everybody. Right, it's one of my favorite books.
Well, no, exactly. That's exactly where I was going, because that was my model. I love that book, Aristotle for Everybody, and thought, well, we need, you know, equivalent for St. Thomas. And there have been some books sort of like that, you know. But I thought an Aquinas for Everyone, something like that. And my publisher, Sophia, had this 1 Minute series. They had the 1 Minute Philosopher, the 1 Minute Apologist, really nice books. So we decided to fit it in that theme. And, you know, well, okay, 1 minute for the Summa Theologica. That book is 1.5 million words. One of my books is typically maybe, you know, 50, 60,000, you know, words. So how do you do that in a minute? Well, our idea was, you know, we're going to actually go through all 38 treatises in that wonderful book and take out some of the key ideas and just do them like in summaries that are maybe just like, you know, one paragraph, one page at a time. So you can get that little chunk, you know, in 1 minute. But then they're, you know, they're chained together so that they tell the story of the Summa as you go through. And, you know, a lot of it is my summary, but I also try to liberally quote from St. Thomas and also to give the citation where exactly this comes from in the Summa, so if people want to dig in for the Thomas's full story, they know right where to go. So that was a labor of love, though. I wanted to write that book right when I came back into the church, but it took me years. You know, I had to get, you know, more immersed in the writings of Thomas and you know, to read more widely before I was able to even, you know, think about producing that one.
Just to try to synthesize the Summa down to something of that size is quite a daunting task. And I can't think of a better Christmas gift, though. I'll have to pick up a handful of those and put them in stockings, because what a great gift to give Aquinas in an accessible fashion to someone.
Well, thank you. I hope you do. I will say that was probably the fastest selling of any of my books, that people ate that one up, and I was very, very pleased, you know, because Thomas had given, you know, so much to me.
Let me turn the conversation just a little bit to something that you've mentioned a couple of times. So you have a doctorate in psychology. I think a lot of times in the current setting that we're in, we seem to have elevated psychology in a way that it kind of displaces philosophy and theology. In other words, people sometimes, you know, there's a kind of secularization that can kind of go along with that. How do you see, maybe explain a little bit, Dr. Vost, on, you know, how does psychology and maybe faith and philosophy all kind of work together?
Yeah, you know, ideally they all should, because they're all just trying to get, you know, the truth of what it is to be a human being. And through our faith, we know that we're made in the image and likeness of God. Through my studies, even some of the more astute pagan philosophers, the Stoics and Aristotle, you know, based on reason, they also had that sense that we are, especially some of the Stoics, Musonius, Rufus, that we are made in the image and likeness of God. And part of the reason is we've been given intellects and wills, you know, alone of all the creatures on the earth. You know, we're the only ones who can do radio shows. You know, there aren't any chimpanzee or dolphin, you know, shows that I know of. You know, underwater cave shows, and I don't think they exist.
Right.
But, you know, so that's what's unique about us. You know, God, there's another book Mortimer Adler wrote, you know, The Difference of Man and the Difference It Makes. There is a total uniqueness there that only we have as a gift from God to be, you know, like him in some small way, in that we can think, we can know things, and we can will, we can desire, we can choose our own behavior. So, you know, ideally, psychology is going to recognize that. I know just in modern psychology, you know, going through my master's program and doctoral training, today there tends to be very little basis in philosophy, or philosophy is just viewed as, you know, a precursor. You know, kind of, you know, back in the Dark Ages, we had to rely on philosophy until the 1870s, when the first psychological laboratory was established, you know, and then we became, you know, enlightened about ourselves. And that's really not the case. You know, I think a good psychologist should know, you know, what came along before experimental psychology, because there was so much grounding there in what it means to be a person and what it means to have passions and emotions and so on. So there, you know, I found, even though the years I was away from the church, there's just such an amazing wealth of wisdom there within the church about human nature. And I'll give one little tiny example. My particular area of expertise was in memory training, memory development. How do we help kids be able to memorize things better? How can we help patients with brain damage cope with certain kinds of memory loss? And in my studies, I found out that within that Summa Theologica itself, Thomas devotes a page to these specific memory techniques that I would later write my master's thesis on. So just amazing how much wisdom there is within the history of all our church teachings for topics as, you know, particular as memory improvement techniques.
Well, you know, and I think that's, you've got a few books out on that, which I actually have one. I've been trying to work my way through, which is Memorizing the Faith, and you also have one on Memorizing the Mass, and then also I think one on Memorizing Reasons, right? Reasons, so sort of an apologetics. But that's share fine. With us just a, what would be just some a couple of quick suggestions on memorizing? I mean, what's sort of the thrust of those books?
Sure. I'll tell you, it's really very simple, and it's kind of fun to go through, to use your mind this way. Thomas says there are four things you do to perfect your memory. Two of them we already know. When you feel like you're studying something, you really want to know something, you're going to repeat it, right? Rehearse it. Because one time usually just doesn't do it. It's not that easy.
All right, Kent, listen up. No.
That's right. That's the second one is exactly right.
This is for
you. You have to pay attention. You have to pay attention. You have to focus. That is the second one. But these other two, he said, you need to take take things that are might be difficult to imagine and make them something you can picture. Make it something that's visible, that you can imagine with your mind's eye, and then use some system to organize them or place them in order. And that's what I do in this memory. I actually lay out a system of order. I use just the parts of a house. Like you walk in the front door. Let me give you a simple example, just a couple. Mm-hmm. You know, let's say you come to my house. You open the front door, and who's standing there? Not me, but your friend Jennifer and her sister. Okay, some person Jennifer and sister there at the front door. That's number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, you walk into my entrance mat at the front door, except instead of being saying welcome, it says exit. You're like, what's this guy want to do? He's trying to get me out of here. But the second one is that exit mat there. And then you look through this glass panel on my front door out to the front yard, and what do you see there but the most hugest pair of Levi jeans you ever saw in the world that are covering my front yard. So what are we doing here? We're going, Jennifer says Genesis, exit mat, Exodus, Levi jeans, Leviticus. So we're getting this ordering system, putting these little symbols that remind us whatever you want to remember. So through a system like this, probably in less than an hour or so for most people, you could memorize all the books of the Old Testament in their exact order by using these little simple little memory images.
Oh, I got to try that. Yeah. That sounds fantastic.
You memorize the faith.
Yes.
Yeah, and my daughter was she went to the National Spelling Bee, so she was very much into spelling, and she did something just sort of naturally very similar to that. She would put the words as she was learning them into a crossword puzzle, and she would attach names to each of the words as she was learning them. So she'd have sort of this list of names that she'd go through, and then when she'd fit the words together in a crossword puzzle, it would help her to know how they were spelled. And so she did this on a board and then used that as a mnemonic device to be able to help her at the spelling bee.
Oh, that's fantastic. And that's another example, how God made us different for all of their species. Some they have, some kind of a memory capacity. But we're the only ones that can use our reason and intellect to totally transform how we remember things. So, your daughter's ingenious method there. These methods, like using the locations, and one aspect of the locations is, once you learn those, they are like a notepad that you have in your head, and you can rewrite brand new, different information on them. So it is amazing. There are so many, wonderful ways that we can transform our ability to do things, to remember things, and to spell words, and for all kinds of tasks.
Well, that brings up a great question, and I think this goes to sort of the genius of scholasticism as it goes towards psychology, and that's the use of imagination within all of these. I mean, obviously, you have to use that faculty of imagination to a high degree to be able to do these mnemonic devices. Can you talk a little bit about that? How the imagination within St. Thomas Aquinas plays a role that may or may not be lost to modern psychology?
Sure. And for Thomas, he somewhat follows and improves on Aristotle's, kind of general system of psychology. And Thomas recognizes that, as human beings, with bodies and souls, information comes into us through the body, through our five senses. Through our, taste and touch and smell and so forth. But as it moves, through our intellect, we're able to imagine things. We can imagine, we can remember things that we've seen. We can also, form in our imagination things that we've never seen, to represent and hold these things for us. And just one of the many ways Thomas talks about the use of imagination, for example, for remembering things is, because information comes in through our body, we can take even abstract ideas and convert them into what he calls corporeal images, or things that we can picture, because then they make it easier for us to remember. So even if we're just trying to remember, key concepts, you can take something super abstract and make it the simplest little concrete reminder. For example, I go through memorizing the Ten Commandments, and for Thou Shalt Not Steal, we're inside this foyer where there's a chandelier over your head, and I say, just imagine it's made out of solid steel. There's no glass, it's just steel. So that very, just the homonym, actual steel, can remind us of the concept Thou shalt not steal. Or you take something as abstract as truth. Sometimes I just have a person, imagine a giant tooth because if they can picture it in their mind's eye, okay, this is where truth comes in, you know, because it's just a cue there. So in some very simple ways, we can use the imagination, you know, to cue us and remind us of a much deeper concept.
And, you know, the imagination, any of these faculties, are they're kind of like muscles. So, you know, the more you use them, the better able you're to use them in the future. And imagination is so crucial, not only for you know, our development of memory, but for our moral development and our ethical development as well. That exercising that moral muscle or our mental muscle of imagination is going to help us in our ethics and in wisdom, just kind of in general, having honestly a better philosophy in general.
You know, exactly, and you hit on something that St. Albert the Great, Thomas's teacher, really emphasized. Because he wrote about these memory methods in the context of the virtue of prudence or practical wisdom. And he said memory is one of the key parts and the most important part, he said, because to achieve virtuous goals in the future, we're going to act now in the present, guided by the moral lessons we've learned in the past. And he said, so therefore, in a sense, memory is the most important part of practical wisdom, because you have to know these moral lessons if you're going to, you know, act upon them. So that's why he encouraged, you know, actually, like you're saying, building our memory muscles, training our memories, so we can, you know, better recall, you know, the facts and the articles of our faith and the moral principles, and retain the lessons from the life experiences we've had. So yeah, when people like St. Albert and St. Thomas were writing about these faculties, I mean, they enjoyed them, you know, as purely intellectual subject matter, but they had practical goals in mind to improve our lives on earth and to help prepare us, you know, for eternal life in heaven.
And I want to remind our audience that we're having a great conversation here with Dr. Kevin Vost, who's a psychologist, but also a fantastic and prolific Catholic author, speaker, professor, radio host. I know you've also got a website, Dr. Vost. Is it drvost.com? Is that where we can access some of your books and writings and learn more about what some of your projects are?
That's right. It's just drvost.com, drvost.com. And I just tell a little about myself, and I don't sell the books from the site, but I have the links to where you can get them, and there's also a contact box if anyone has any comments or questions for me.
And that's how I got a hold of you, so I'm so glad you have that there, and it works.
Yeah, my son set that up, so I'm thankful to him.
Hey, I would love, this is fascinating about psychology and philosophy and sort of the nature of the human person. I also want, I understand, Dr. Vost, that you maybe have a close connection with the Dominicans, and is, could maybe talk a little bit about, I'd love to hear a little bit about kind of Dominican spirituality, and maybe how that relates back into, say, philosophy. But tell us a little bit about that.
Sure, and the timing couldn't be better, because I happened to be blessed yesterday to hear Father Bruno Cadori, the current Master General of the Order. He just gave a talk in St. Louis, 100 miles from my home, so I just heard him yesterday, so just fired up with the contact with the Dominicans. But anyway, you know, this order that is this year celebrating its 800th Jubilee year, you know, it's been around almost exactly as long as the Franciscans. These two wonderful orders came about in the early 1200s. But the Dominicans have always had a special place in my life. I was taught through grade school by Dominican sisters. Later in life, you know, those writings of St. Thomas brought me back to Christ, and Thomas himself was a Dominican. You know, and later I got to do some teaching and talks for some Dominican schools, like the Nashville sisters down there.
Oh, I'd love them.
Aquinas College.
Yes.
Yeah. So the Dominicans have always had a special place for me, you know, just because I shouldn't say happenstance, you know, God, you know, saw this, but I was, you know, taught by them. And then later in my life I realized this is an order that just so particularly speaks to me, with their special emphasis on study and prayer, contemplating, but then passing that along to others, and their great passion, you know, for preaching and learning. So I've just been blessed really throughout my life by all the good things that the Dominicans do.
Were there, in this talk that you heard yesterday, in this great Jubilee, this 800-year anniversary, what were one or two sort of things that you think our audience really might want to hear or walk away with?
Okay, yeah, great. Obviously, you know, so many things you can say about St. Dominic, the founder. Right. But it is said he always carried with him, you know, because manuscripts were big and bulky. To carry the whole Bible would be quite an undertaking. But so he always carried with him the Gospels of St. Matthew and the letters of Paul. And one of the things about Matthew was Dominic was fighting this heresy where they said, like, the world is evil and God is, you know, only the spirit is good. And he's saying, no, the world is good too. The body is good. Christ took on a body. So he, you know, emphasized those lessons from St. Matthew. Well, the Master General yesterday was, you know, endorsing all that, but also he chose to pull some verses from St. Luke where he says, you know, go and do likewise. And Jesus is talking about gathering these men and women disciples around them, and then, you know, asking them to, you know, to go out in the world. So that is, you know, really the heart of the Dominican mission, is to go out and preach, go out and spread that good word, and to do it from a sense of community. You know, when Dominic sent his preachers out, originally it was in groups of twos. You know, so they form these friendships and they go out and support each other and spread that, you know, that good word of Christ.
That's fantastic. Could you tell us a little bit about, I know one of your more recent books is The Porch and the Cross, Ancient Stoic Wisdom for Modern Christian Living. Tell us, maybe it seems to suggest that there's, you know, an ancient wisdom out there, but kind of like Mark was talking about earlier, why should we care about what people wrote, you know, hundreds or even maybe a couple thousand years ago? How could that, why would that even be relevant to today, much less contributing to, say, you know, our happiness or well-being?
Yeah, and that's a great question, because, you know, there is, you know, what some would call like a chronological snobbery. We tend to have this idea that, you know,
right,
we're so enlightened today, you know, compared to everybody who came before us. But even in the field of psychology, it was kind of mired for a time in the 20th century with Freud and psychoanalysis making it look like, oh, all that matters is what happened when you were a young child, or behaviorism that said there's really no such thing as mind, we just look at people's outward behaviors. In the 1960s, there was something called the cognitive revolution in psychology. We're going to start like rediscovering the mind and how we think and everything. And two systems of therapy arose, rationally motive therapy from Albert Ellis and cognitive therapy from Aaron Beck in the 1950s and 60s. And the kernel for their idea came from these ancient Stoic philosophers, Epictetus from the 1st and 2nd century A.D., just this idea that we're not just automatically influenced in how we think and feel by what happens outside us. What really determines our reactions are how we think about things, our own attitudes and reactions to things, you know. And from this, they kind of build a modern system of psychotherapy, but the germs of those ideas, you know, were out there for thousands of years. So when I did this book, The Porch and the Cross on the Stoics, you know, I wanted to show some of that wisdom out there. I knew that it was so valuable in learning how to control our passions and being more rational. Trying to follow God by reason is what the Stoics did. Their reason led them to a God. But I'll just tell you, the one big surprise I had in writing that book, Epictetus' teacher was a man named Musonius Rufus. And in what we have, the remnants of his teachings, he laid out, I bullet pointed maybe 10 or 12 things where his teaching, even on things like the value of a family, of marriage, abortion, even contraception, align with the teachings of the Catholic Church. So here we have these pro-life messages, even in these ancient philosophers, just based on a true knowledge and understanding of human nature. So that kind of wowed me. So it shows that there are all kinds of truths that people, thoughtful people, have had throughout the centuries that we can mine, and that's always been the Church's position. You know, we don't care where the truth came from if it's true.
Yeah, that's always been, I'm a convert too, and honestly, that compatibility of faith and reason is really what drew me to the Church as well, that there is just one truth, and it's expressed by the teachings of the Catholic Church, but it's also expressed by our learning and our rational explorations of the universe, and the two are compatible, and they work off of each other, and they don't contradict. It's an amazing, very, very mysterious, when you start to contemplate it, thing about the Catholic Church and how revelation came to be, that it corroborates everything that humanity has learned throughout the ages.
Exactly. When I was away from the Church, you know, one of the atheists even said faith and reason go together like poison and food. You know, and when I came back, I saw that compatibility, you know.
Yeah.
John Paul said that, you know, they're the two wings upon which we fly to truth. So, yeah, that's what was my great aha, too, to see this wonderful compatibility from faith and reason and how the Church has embraced them all along.
Well, we've had a wonderful conversation today with you, Dr. Kevin Vost, and we're going to begin to wrap things up here. So tell our listeners where, you know, they might learn more about your books, more about your projects, how they might get in touch with you.
Sure. You know, my website is just drvost.com, drvost.com. We mentioned I have a comment box there, and I'd just be happy to hear from anyone who had any questions or comments.
We loved your work and your books, ranging from The 1 Minute Aquinas. We were just talking about The Porch and the Cross, Ancient Stoic Wisdom for Modern Christian Living. But I got to tell you, I got to dig in. I encourage everyone else to. I want to learn more about these memorization techniques that you brought up on the show about how we might go about memorizing the faith, the mass, reasons for that. I happen to be involved in catechesis at the parish, so always looking for ways to help pass along the authentic faith. And so I can't wait to get my hands on some of those techniques. And boy, we've got to have you back here really, really soon, Dr. Vost.
Oh, I would love to. This has been a great conversation. I really enjoyed this. Great questions, gentlemen.
Oh, one other thing before I let you go. You've got a book called Three Irish Saints. Who are they?
Oh, the saints are St. Patrick. He's my model doer.
Okay.
St. Bridget. She's my model of being a lover.
Yeah.
And my own namesake, St. Kevin of Glendalough, not so widely
known. Oh, there we go. So we got the first two pretty readily, but we were wondering, who's the third?
So. Yeah. Excellent. Okay. So anyone looking to buy me a Christmas gift, I'd love to get that book. Well, again, thank you, Dr. Vost. It's been a pleasure, and thank you for coming into the Catholic Cave.
Oh, you're most welcome. My pleasure, and God bless you all.
Three things keep Catholic Radio Indy on the air. One is our fervent desire to spread the gospel message. Two is your donations to the station. We couldn't survive without them. And three is underwriting from area businesses. Every month, these businesses make donations to the station. Please support them. Visit their stores, send them an email, or call them. Let them know that you appreciate their support of Catholic Radio. It's a great way to thank our underwriters for their very important support.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
Anytime you get in the car, turn on the radio, you know that there's going to be something encouraging.
It's such an encouragement and enriching to my own Christian walk.
It brings me a great deal of peace.
I really am blessed whenever I listen.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle, still here with Timothy O'Donnell, and we just got done having a fantastic conversation with Dr. Kevin Vost.
I'm still catching my breath.
I know. We covered a tremendous amount of ground.
What a great guest.
Oh, yeah. And, that 1 minute Aquinas, I have not...
Stocking stuffer for Christmas. You got to get it.
Exactly, yeah.
Get a whole stack of them for friends and family.
You know, and I mean, it fits right in with what our goals here are at the Catholic Cave, which is just try to reacquaint people with the Catholic philosophical tradition, because it's gotten lost over the ages. I mean, I think we as a society have kind of lost our philosophical roots as Catholics, and we need to recapture it so that we can be a part of the public square, be a part of what's going on in the world. I think there's a time where we've got to retreat back to our caves, figuratively speaking, so that we can recapture our own tradition and then come out of the cave and try to enlighten everybody else.
Well, it's much to our detriment when we throw away the truth. And philosophy is one of the disciplines where we can, the truth has been discovered over the past couple thousand years, and some of that truth is unchanging. And so it's foolish to simply discard or kind of offhandedly sort of set that stuff aside and pretend it doesn't matter.
Well, guys, one of the things that I find interesting is the fact that most of the time that we find someone talking about Aquinas and talking about how he brought them back into the church, we're talking about converts. Whereas those of us who are cradle Catholics, Aquinas, I think I studied him in third grade and he was one of the saints we covered. But as cradle Catholics, we never really got into the ability to study these great minds and these great doctors of the church. And it's a treasure that we've kind of missed that, you know, now that we've got so many converts coming back to the church as a result of these great minds, they're pointing it out to those of us who missed it the first time.
I think there's two things going on there. On the one hand, I think a convert can bring fresh eyes to something that I think as somebody raised
with a zeal.
You know, somebody who's raised in the faith you know, they're overly familiar, I think, with the thought of Thomas Aquinas. They're overly familiar with what the church teaches, and so they take it for granted, where a convert doesn't take it for granted. The second thing, a convert knows, I think, better than somebody that's been raised in the church, what's missing in the philosophy of the world. So they feel that emptiness that the world has offered, or that other philosophies or other thoughts have offered. And they see that, you know, that void is really filled by somebody like St. Thomas Aquinas, or somebody like Albert the Great, or some of the other great Catholic philosophers out there. They see the void filled by Catholic thought, and that's what draws them into the church.
Well, I think one of the risks that we face is, I'm a credo Catholic, one of the risks we face is that the faith is reduced to mere custom, so that over familiarity, or just becomes custom, or just kind of a routine. What happens over time, where the risk comes in, is that it can take on kind of a superficial quality to it, kind of like team affiliations. Like, you know, I'm a Colts fan, and so I love the Colts, and maybe I build a whole routine about watching the game, wearing the logo gear, rooting for them, that kind of stuff. But then when they have, say, a bad season or two, or there's changes to the roster or coaching staff or whatever I don't like, I simply do what? I change affiliations, and right. I become a Packers fan or something like that, right? And so we see that with Catholics sometimes, right? People who are, you know, the credo Catholics, but haven't allowed, or for some reason, the faith is sort of atrophied in their souls. And what's happened is they then feel like free to what? Well, if I'm not getting sort of the emotional fulfillment out of going to this parish, okay, I might change parishes, but it's probably more likely I might as well just try something else altogether. Like there's here in central Indiana, there's just a gazillion different
right.
kinds of flavors of Christianity you can try.
Well, I think one of the things that I see, and I was a catechist for a number of years, is the fact that in many, many ways, we have a couple of generations within Catholicism, at least here in the United States, that are very well sacramentalized, but not very well catechized. And so
the danger.
We hear yeah. about St. Thomas, but we don't really know what he taught. And so it's those kinds of things that the converts are pointing out to us, and, you know, we're going back and looking and saying, wait, I missed that in my education.
Yeah, and you know, converts play that role, I think. You know, it's a very important role that, you know, God in his providence has made it so that, yeah, the church has to constantly be renewing itself with new blood. I remember when Scott Hahn was, you know, first coming into the church, prolifically writing and putting forth really what was almost an evangelical Catholicism. It was such a breath of fresh air coming in of really this evangelical zeal that he took from being an evangelical Christian, but bringing it into the context of Catholicism. And, you know, there's a reciprocity there too. He was able to Catholicize a lot of right. evangelical Christianity, and he brought a lot of converts with him because
of that.
And still does. And, you know, it's kind of funny. We started off the show talking a little bit about what happened with the Enlightenment. And I think the reason we had the Enlightenment was a similar ossification of the church towards the close of the Middle Ages. That energy of new ideas and new thoughts and converts and things coming in had kind of stopped. And so the church became kind of ossified. And so the Enlightenment in some ways was a reaction against that sort of, I guess, stagnation of the
yeah.
faith.
And outside the church, there was also a kind of glamour of innovation, right? You begin to have the dawn of the scientific method. You begin to have a progress begins to accelerate, and there's an excitement with that. There's a discovery of the new world by Columbus, and just a lot of stuff just yep. begins to happen that again, sort of, and we sit in our own times in I would say technology does that for us, right? That technology often is can be a lure away from the faith because of the way it can, if we allow it, obviously, right, to what? Preoccupy us or displace things. So the time that we spend, I mean, when you hear about the time that the average American spends on the internet or on in front of a television, things like that, that's time that maybe isn't being spent doing what? in prayer,
right?
Or studying the faith, or helping, because it's hard to imagine. I just heard this, a parishioner shared this story about someone who's a lifelong Catholic, and who is now thinking, the priest at his parish kind of retired and, you know, felt a connection. But now that priest is gone, well, now things are up for grabs. So he was interested in checking out this local non-denominational. And it's kind of like, well, how is that even possible? I mean, if you really believed and understood the truth of the real presence of our Lord in the Eucharist, body, blood, soul, and divinity, you're not leaving for the non-denominational church, right?
Yeah.
So there is this is someone who's been, to Kent's point earlier, someone who's been sacramentalized. They've received all the sacraments of initiation. I would imagine have been going to Holy Mass and receiving Holy Communion worthily. But now just feels like, but it never somehow, or at least at this point in that person's life, it's still just sort of custom or routine, an interchangeable component, like changing NFL teams.
Right. And, you know, that sort of turning the faith into just sort of habit and custom, you know, it seems that there's a cycle that happens, and then you have saints or movements within the church that break us out of that. And, you know, we were talking about St. Dominic, and, you know, St. Francis and St. Dominic, they go together. They came about at about the same time.
Yes, yeah.
You know, a similar sort of habituation of the faith had happened prior to them, and they came independently
of each
other.
And they offered something new.
And they offered something brand
new. But within the tradition.
And refreshed the church. And so you had that sort of new ideas coming in to consistently sort of, I guess, sort of churn the waters up a little bit to keep things fresh.
Right. And I think that's so key for us as Catholics is the church is made up of sinners, and the church needs to be sort of renewed from time to time. And so, but that renewal should always come from within Holy Mother Church, right? We should never break away and leave because we're frustrated or we're upset. We need to work for effective change to continue to add to the luster of Holy Mother Church, of the truths of the faith, to the best of our ability. And that's where I think Dr. Vost has been such a great guest, because I mean, I was captivated by, and I really got to figure out more, because I'm getting older, Mark, my memory isn't what it used to be, but the fact that he's written three books on memorizing the faith, the Mass, apologetics, boy, I'm super interested in that for myself and others.
I would have loved to have talked to him a little bit more about the role that technology has played in us diminishing our mental abilities and our memory. You know, when you've got everything at your fingertips.
Oh, when everything's a Twitter, Twitter bite.
Or, you know, the answer to anything, you can just quickly pull up and Google it, so you don't have the need to remember it because it's right there at your fingertips.
Right.
Yeah, I think we're losing our memory abilities, not just for old age.
Well, you know, even basics. I mean, why do I have to memorize multiple tables when I've got a calculator in my phone?
Exactly. So technology in a lot of ways it's enhanced what we've been able to do. But on the other hand, I think it's in some ways diminished the human capacity of being able to do a lot of this on our own.
Yeah, I mean, technology is not an unmitigated good. There's a lot of goods that come with it. But it's much more of a mixed bag. And so you might be listening to me and say, there's that caveman again, you know, rejecting technology. And I have an iPhone. I love it. But however, technology, though, does a lot of good, but it brings with it a lot of problems, too, and a lot of things that we have to be aware. It's not benign. It's active, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm so glad Dr. Vost said that he'd be happy to be back, because there's that whole line of topic I'd love to talk to him about. You know, we started, you know, mentioning that St. Thomas Aquinas is kind of a saint for our times. St. Dominic is too.
Yes.
And so I would have loved
Order
to talk,
preachers.
Exactly,
yes.
Talked with him longer about St. Dominic, what that Dominican spirituality has to offer our day and age particularly. We'll definitely have to bring Dr. Vost back at some point.
And the fact that he has a book on three Irish saints, I mean, that's a show in itself.
as long as we do our long-awaited show on German philosophy.
Oh, we're going to have to do that. Yeah, exactly. Yes, yeah. We're going to bring in like the Heideggers and the Kants. And,
exactly.
Oh, maybe even Hegel and barbecue them all, as far as I'm concerned.
Between Tim and Kent, I can't let you guys get too Irish on me.
That's right.
Well, you know, I like to look back and think, you know, yes, I do have some Irish in my background, but my family got run out of England in the 1500s. So, you know, that's only because we were Catholic.
Ah, that's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's about all the time we have for the Catholic Cave today. We hope you'll join us every week. If you need to catch up on something that you might have missed early in the program, remember, this is available on a podcast on CatholicRadioIndy.org. Until next time, take care. God bless.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of The Catholic Cave. If you have a question or comment regarding this program, please address an email to Kent, K-E-N-T, at CatholicRadioIndy.org or call 317-870-8400. Replays of this program are available on podcast at CatholicRadioIndy.org. Just click on the programming tab, then go to podcasts of local programs.